something was missing in my life. Don't look at it as getting the job, not getting the job. Look at it as a chance to do what it is that you say you love to do. I was what's called up, meaning, you know, my name was a lot of places. He's like, Dad, I want to become, you know, like a Buddhist monk. And I'm like, oh, that's a great idea. I'm totally for it, but you also got to pay bills.
All right. Hey, guys, welcome back to the studio. Today, we have a special guest, pop culture icon, actor, writer, and producer, Corin Nemec. Welcome to the studio, Corin.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. Appreciate you having me here.
Yeah. So you're out there in Florida. How's the weather?
Hot and sticky.
Yes. it's cold and rainy here today, shockingly. Mm. So either it's 100 degrees or it's raining and cold.
That sounds fantastic to me, actually. I would love a cold, rainy day right now because here we do get quite a bit of rain as well, but the temperature doesn't decrease when it's raining.
Right. Yeah, I'm familiar. My folks are out there. I always love a good trip, a good visit out that way.
Yeah, Florida's got a beautiful state to live in. It's got plenty of beaches. It's
plenty
all beaches.
Beaches
and swamp. That's it. That's what you get. You get marshes, swamps, or beaches. I prefer the beaches.
Now, has the novelty of the beach worn off at all? I know a lot of people kind of disconnect. It's like you have access to it all day and night. So
yeah, man, I'm barely a mile away from the beach. I'm actually on the intercoastal. I'm two blocks from the intercoastal, but the beach is across the bridge where I'm at on the Clearwater coast. There's, you know, a bunch of sandbar islands that are off the coast there. And that's where all the beaches are on the I guess that would be considered kind of the southwestern side of the islands there. But actually, of late, I really have been taking advantage of it because I find that I love living near the beach and I don't use the beach a lot. And lately, at the end of the day, at least four times a week, more recently, around like an hour before sundown, I'll go out there and go for a swim because the Gulf water is like, it can be like 78, 82, 84 degrees, you know? So it's not like, you know, it's super hot out and you go and you jump in the water. You're like, what am I in a bath? Like, you know,
right.
so it's nicer closer to the end of the day, when the sun's going down. Plus the sunsets are gorgeous on the Gulf Coast. Just beautiful.
Oh, absolutely. When I go out and visit my folks, I go to a nearby beach in Inglewood, and there's a couple that does sunset yoga. It's amazing, and they do it like 365 days a year. It's a great experience, and usually there's some dolphins jumping, you know, playing.
Oh,
in the water.
Hey, where there's yoga, there's dolphins. I mean, that's what I always say.
Yeah, I'm not any good at yoga. Yeah, I'm not any good at yoga, but I get out there and I do it, and it's nice and it's enjoyable to do it in the sand, and you got that beautiful view with the ocean right there, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I went to my sister was into that hot yoga. What's it called?
Bikram.
Yeah, Bikram yoga. She took me to one of those places once. Dude, it was so hot and sweaty and stinky in there, and yes. I mean, it just smelled like a men's locker room, you know. So unrelaxing and like,
yeah.
And someone like ripped one while we were in there somewhere in this crowd of people. Someone just let one loose. I was like, bro, if it's not bad enough, I'm never coming back here.
Is hilarious because I've done Bikram yoga and it is exactly what you just described. It's exactly that. And someone let one rip in there too.
Dude, what is it with the hot and the yoga and the just, are they so, they're like, man, it's natural. Everybody does it. Yeah, everybody does it, but you don't got to do it here.
Right. And it's such a tight squeeze too. Like there was no room to really move. I didn't find it enjoyable. I love taking a sauna by myself, but no yoga involved. Like a solo sauna, I'm good with. But
bro, I'm all about the saunas, man. That's like that's if I had my own sauna here at my place, that's like one of my dreams is to have an in-house, you know, dry sauna, but with the hot lava rocks, you can pour a little water on, steam it up a little bit, you know. That's heaven to me. That's absolutely. And I bet
in the dead of winter would be
fantastic.
Yes, I have a great tip for you. I was actually putting my place together, my north house that I was telling you about, and I had all the hookups put in for a sauna. I was going to do exactly that. And then I found this pop-up sauna for just a few hundred bucks, just a couple hundred bucks. And it's a steam sauna, and it's like, ooh, it's like 7 feet tall. You can put it up, take it down,
what? Clean it.
Comes with a little chair. I'm going to send you the link. You're going to love it. It's a game changer.
Dude, that sounds rad.
It's
just
amazing.
Just take it with me everywhere.
Yeah. I don't take it with me anywhere. I have it set up in my garage. I turned my garage into a gym, and so I just popped it up there, and it stays. It's perfect.
Yeah, I can tell. Awesome. I can tell by your svelteness and that tight shirt you're about to burst out of that you go to the gym regularly.
Hey, if it ain't tight, it ain't right.
That's right. That's exactly right. I like to wear my shirts small, too. Makes me look bigger, even though I'm not.
If I wear anything bigger than this, it looks like I'm swimming in it. So
yeah, same here, brother.
Man, so hey, the audience knows you from your breakout role in Parker Lewis Can't Lose, but man, you know where I first saw you was my first name is Steven. To this day, I remember that movie. What a fantastic role that was, and that was a true story. I was wondering if you'd share a little bit about that role, because I actually remember watching that on TV. We're not far apart in age. You're my brother's age. I'm just a few years younger than you. I was born in 77.
Okay. Yeah, man. That, you know, I know my first name is Steven was a major project at the time. The audition process for it was something else. They had one of the scenes. I think I got the part for this reason, because one of the scenes was when Steven was on the witness stand talking about, you know, what had happened to him when he was in captivity with the disgusting pedophile. And it was so uncomfortable. The dialogue was so uncomfortable that I naturally felt very uncomfortable doing the scene. You know, it was just, it was, I didn't feel comfortable in my skin. You know, I felt so uncomfortable that I think that's what got me the part, was just the fact that I naturally, organically was not comfortable with the whole process. And you know, being 14, not a novice actor, I'd been acting professionally since I was 12 and had been studying acting since I was 11, but had some experience with some dramatic acting and comedic acting. I mean, before getting I Know My First Name is Steven, I had just finished filming an Eddie Murphy TV pilot called What's Alan Watching as the starring character in that. And it was a comedy with Fran Drescher and Barbara Barry and Peter Michael Getz. And obviously Eddie Murphy was in it, Pauly Shore, very young Pauly Shore. And you know, that went really, really well, but it didn't get picked up. And I'd also starred as Nikki Papadopoulos in the last season of Webster.
I do remember that too.
His live-in cousin. And, so, you know, I really didn't think I was going to get that part, and I got the role, and I was like, wow, this is like a level beyond what I'm used to in terms of what the layers that they needed to hit with that character. I ended up working with an incredible acting coach named John Len, who was out of the Actors Studio East Coast and was a senior member of the Actors Studio West Coast. And we went over for about 2 weeks straight. I think we might have worked at a minimum of 5 days a week, maybe six, and probably 6 hour sessions or so, 4 to 6 hour sessions each day, just breaking down the character, rehearsing the dialogue, finding the beats and moments. It was a really incredible introduction into a deeper level of understanding about the craft of acting. Even though I'd studied with some great teachers, even up to that point, no one as you know, dialed in as this guy was. And so that helped a lot, because once I got to set, I was already so relaxed about everything that we had to do, all the scenes, the complexity of them, the uncomfortableness of them. And it turned out to just be a much easier job and experience than I was initially projecting for it. And you know, working with that cast and everybody else, it was a great experience. I got an Emmy nomination,
yeah,
you know, at that age, and that was wild as well, you know, being so young at the time. And a couple of years later, I was on Parker Lewis, which I got that role because of What's Alan Watching. You can still find clips of What's Alan Watching on YouTube and stuff. At one point, there was the whole episode was on YouTube, and it's hilarious. But I got that because the creators of the show, Lon Diamond and Clyde Phillips, at least Clyde Phillips was, he was a contract writer at CBS. And that's where the show aired, and he was writing Parker Lewis for CBS years before it ended up on Fox. And they didn't pick it up, but it was around the same time as What's Alan Watching that he was writing Parker Lewis. And he was like, dude, that's the kind of show I want to make. Something that just ignores all of the norms of filmmaking and storytelling and breaking the fourth wall and just, you know, not paying any attention to what's expected and doing it as a single camera comedy instead of a sitcom, you know, a three or four camera comedy. And so, you know, CBS didn't pick it up, probably fortunately, and years later after Ferris Bueller came out, because the show was actually written before Ferris Bueller. Ferris Bueller came out, became such a huge success that was like a trend, that kind of a storyline. And then the movie 3 o'clock High with Casey Shamosko would come out, and that was the cinematic style that Clyde Phillips based Parker Lewis on, was the cinematic style of that show. And that was it, you know. I fortunately, because I had done What's Alan Watching, when they got the green light at Fox, he called up and I got the offer, and I was like, what? And I had such a terrible experience doing sitcoms when I was on Webster. I was like, I will never ever do a sitcom ever again. And sure enough, he told me that it wasn't a sitcom. It was a single camera show and that it was going to be completely different. So,
wow, that's so cool. And congratulations on that. I mean, you deserve that. That was such a impactful movie. And just to give the audience a little bit of context, the movie, I Know My First Name is Steven, that was based on a true story about a young man that was kidnapped by a man and then later reunited with his family. I remember that movie vividly. And then what was the experience like on Webster that kind of soured you for sitcoms at that point?
Mainly it was the lead actors, you know, Mam and George, they were married in real life when they first started the show, and they were divorced, I don't know how many seasons into the show, I think later on, maybe the 10th season or whatever. And I was in season 12. Or something like whatever it was, like 11 or 12 or whatever season it was. And at that point they hated each other. The last thing they wanted to do was be on set together, especially pretending to be a loving family. It was just an extremely unpleasant working environment especially as a young actor, when I was so excited to be on Webster, which was a show I was, you know, very familiar with, having grown up with Webster myself. I was so excited to be on the show, and it was nightmarish. So I just assumed that every half hour comedy was like that.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't really differentiate at that young age, and having not been in a whole lot of projects, I did do, you know, a pilot episode around that same time called Cadets with Soleil Moonfry and Jenny Lewis and some other people that didn't get picked up, and I was shocked. But that was a great experience, and that was it was a sitcom style show, but it wasn't, we didn't shoot in front of a live audience because it was just a pilot episode. But I think the intention was potentially for it to be in front of a live audience, but it was about a military school, young kids in a military school.
Your resume is so impressive too, and it's so long. You have a long working resume. It's amazing. And it's just some of the shows, I mean, I can't read all of them off because that list is a mile. But like, you had Parker Lewis, but you did some NYPD Blue, CSI New York, and CSI Miami, NCIS, NCIS Los Angeles, Beverly Hills 90210. And that's interesting because that's my era. So I remember 90210, and I remember you specifically in that role. You were like a financial swindler of the Valerie character.
Yeah, I stole all of Tiffany Amber Thiessen's money and got away with it.
Yes.
See, I was in my fourth episode when I split the country or whatever and left with her money. I went home going, dude, they got to bring this character back, obviously, because they've just left open this huge can of worms, and you know they're going to have to circle back and bust this guy, and then they never did. They were like, yeah, he got away with it. I was like, dude, what kind of who's the head of the writing team over there? I was totally shocked that they let this character get away with it.
A great character. That was a great role. I remembered it specifically as I was reading through. I was like, oh yeah, Derek Driscoll, he scammed Valerie, and they had like looped you in through the character Kelly's dad, like you were posing as his business partner or something crazy. Yes.
Yeah.
That's fun. What was that experience like? Because you had like a 4-episode arc on that?
Yeah, 4 episodes on that. It was cool. I was already, you know, because 90210, Married with Children, In Living Color, all this, you know, all those shows. I mean, obviously Married with Children was on well before we came on to Fox, but all those other shows all started up the same year we did in 1990, 91. We were at all the events together. I knew all of those actors. Actually, Jason Priestley and I hung out quite a bit off camera. And that was, so it was a great time to be on the show. I know that there would have been a couple of other parts that they'd been interested in for me to play, shortly after Parker Lewis went off of the air. I think that they were just so caught up in me being Parker Lewis, forgetting the dramatic work that I had done also. And I ended up actually auditioning for that role, which is how I got it, because the other ones, my agents were kind of like, offer only, what are you talking about? We're Fox, he's Fox, everybody's Fox, you know,
right.
Just give him the part.
Yeah.
And you know, cause I did keep up. I was very concerned about being typecast in the role of Parker Lewis. So every hiatus, instead of taking, you know, the months off of work, you know, I would do a very dramatic movie of the week or something. Like the first hiatus, I did one called For the Very First Time. It was a wonderful coming of age story that took place in the 1950s, a great, great movie of the week. And then the next one, I did My Son Johnny with Rick Schroeder, which was very dramatic. It was along the same lines as I Know My First Name Is Steven type of a role, about based on a true story about, you know, an abusive home life and, you know, a kid who murdered his brother because his brother always abused him and he had to go to court about it, and he ends up getting off on the charges. They consider it kind of self-defense, and it was a crazy story when it happened. And then the third the third hiatus, I did a life force experiment with Donald Sutherland, which was really rad. Heavy dramatic role there. And that was, I didn't want to end up in that situation where, dude, you do one series, you play the character great, and you never work again. You know what I mean?
Well, you were definitely no flash in the pan. You've had a long running career doing many things, and you're a writer, producer.
Well, getting The Stand, the miniseries The Stand, was a big boost for me. Playing Harold Lauder in The Stand, it was such a role that was outside the norm for me as an actor, such a weird, quirky character. My first time doing a real character piece that was like so, you know, so against the grain for the roles that I had always played in the past. And And that really, really opened up the doors for me to do a lot of other roles where I was playing the bad guy, so to speak. You know, I started getting cast in other movies of the week, like Summer of Fear. There was one called Summer of Fear, and there was one called Blackout, where you know, it was about a mall blackout, and I was the bad guy in that. And then My Brother's Keeper, that John Badham also directed. I worked with him first on Drop Zone with Wesley Snipes. And me and John Badham got along really, really great. And he cast me a number of years later in a bigger role in Brother's Keeper, which was awesome. And then, obviously I kept doing the comedy as well, getting cast in Operation Dumbo Drop with Ray Liotta and Danny Glover and Dennis Leary. And let me tell you something, being stuck in Thailand for nearly 6 months with Dennis Leary, that's a comedy show.
Yeah.
That dude was over being in Thailand, over being in what's called a third world country. You know, he was over it the first week we were there. He was, oh, like, you know what I mean? So from week two until, you know, 5.5 months later, it was a constant litany of hilarious complaints and scenarios and experiences that he had while he was there. It was hilarious.
Oh my God. And then Stargate too. You had a great run on Stargate.
I should have had a bigger run. It was unfortunate the way that whole thing worked out. It was a peculiar scenario where when Hollywood politics and the crazy fandom and corporate corporate paranoia comes into play. And, when I started working on that show, it was the first season that Sci-Fi Channel had picked up the show. And Michael Shanks, who played Daniel Jackson, had decided that he wanted to go on and do other things after season 5 when it left HBO. And I think he was obviously concerned that once it hit Sci-Fi Channel, that the quality might decrease or something else might happen to it, because that was a big shift going from a classy place like HBO to Sci-Fi Channel at that time, you know, which was still trying to get its roots in really, really good series. And so the fandom at that time, who were rabid Daniel Jackson fans, just inundated Sci-Fi Channel and MGM with a letter writing campaign that was, I mean, you're talking boxes of letters, you know, not like a couple letters, literally boxes of letters like Santa Claus receives every damn year, you know, or used to when now he gets emails. But this was all unbeknownst to me. So I'm just sitting there going, okay, cool. My character's, you know, is the new main fourth member of the team or whatever. They're doing some great storylines for me. They had said that they were thinking about taking my character and rolling him onto Atlantis, which that was supposed to be the final season of SG-1, was our first season on Sci-Fi Channel, and then they were going to roll into Atlantis after that. So I was like, wow, this is going to be great. But behind the scenes, the network was panicking that once they started airing the episodes, you know, they're spending $2.5 million or so per episode, and they're like freaking out that they're not going to get the views and that they're going to, you know, have this big boondoggle and have spent all this money and lost it. So behind the scenes, they were coaxing Michael Shanks back onto the show and doing, you know, negotiations that obviously I wasn't privy to. And this was before even one episode I was in had aired.
Wow.
So by the time they had made a deal with him, and then they brought him back on, he started doing a reoccurring character on the season 6 again. I think he was in 2 or 3 episodes. So they were introducing that, oh, you know, he's back. He's able to be alive. He's back in the world. He's, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, he's not dead, you know? And I thought, you know, it was just like, that was just cool that they were just kind of, you know, whatever. But sure enough, once we finished up the season 6, I didn't get a call for the renewal for season 7. And finally, you know, not long before Christmas, I got the call and was like, oh, Merry Christmas. Well, we're not bringing you back next. We're going to bring you back for like 3 episodes and, you know, then we'll see. And I was like, oh, wow, that's so scandalous. But oddly enough, once my episodes did start airing, if they had just relaxed and given it a chance, people really embraced Jonas Quinn, the character I created, and I won over the majority of the audience by the end of the season. And then suddenly they wrote me out of the show. Oh. So that's just where, you know, how Hollywood can be very fickle and untrustworthy of the future. That's why you see a lot of repetition in Hollywood when it comes to films and TV shows, a lot of remakes and redos and number twos and number threes and number fours and number tens, and, you know, instead of really great classic original content. There's so much money going into some of these productions. There's a paranoia that is palpable, you know?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask too, like, with all that being said, I mean, what a tough business, and to actually have a working resume like you have, so impressive, and keeping things up. I mean, had you ever experienced any depression through those times, just with experiences and, you know, you think things are going to go one way and then boom, it goes another way? I mean, how do you keep yourself motivated to keep on with the business
I think what got me, I always maintained a presence in acting classes, even up until I was on Parker Lewis. I studied it when I first started studying acting when I was 11, was at Center Stage LA with an acting teacher named Kevin McDermott, who was amazing. And he used a lot of improv, dramatic improv, comedic improv, improvising the scenes. Like, we'd memorize a scene, then he'd say, forget the dialogue, do the scene, but just get the essence of what the character needs and wants out of the scene, and don't try and stress about the dialogue. Because when you're a young actor, or when you're an actor just starting, no matter what age you are, there can be a lot of attention and stress and fear about messing up a line or not remembering your dialogue, and that can create a stage fright, you know, and really affect a performance. So he wanted to get us away from that and that really worked great. And then I studied with a teacher named Terrence Hines after that. And at Terrence Hines' place, you know, some of my the actors I was in there with, Stephen Dorff and Brian Austin Green and some other actors that were there at the time. And that was before 90210, obviously, but Brian was on Knott's Landing at the time. He was somewhat well known, but that was a great class too. And then I went on and studied with Larry Moss after that while I was working on Parker Lewis. So I'd be, you know, like at on set, I'm like, dude, I got a scene tonight, you know, in my acting class. And well, am I, what's going on? So I ended up about a year and a half into the Parker Lewis, I just couldn't take the acting class anymore because our shooting schedule was so long. I was missing two or three classes a month, you know, and he was only doing 4 classes a month for the master's class. And I just like, this is pointless, you know. So I stopped studying. And then about a year and a half after Parker Lewis went off the air, I felt like something was missing in my life. Like I screwed the pooch on an important audition for Primal Fear, you know, and I could have gotten that role if I had just not been caught up in this kind of laissez-faire Hollywood attitude about acting and my career and who I thought I was and past successes and all of this stuff that was really kind of messing with my mind and being, you know, battling with that ego that like is trying to believe my own hype in the PR world or in the teen mags or on the talk shows or whatever the case may be. And I was like, whoa, man, this is, where am I? What's going on here? And my good friend Ernie Reyes Jr., we were hanging out, and he was like, dude, you know, you got to just get back into an acting class. And I was like, bro, that's exactly what I need to do. And he was studying with this teacher named Manu Tupou at the American Repertory Company in Hollywood at the time. And Manu just turned out to be a mind-blowing teacher. In fact, I wrote a book here, Creating a Character for the Stage or Life, that is based on the new era acting technique that was his technique that he came up with. You can find this on lulu.com if you're interested in reading it, lulu.com. Once I got into his class, I was sold. This guy had a very spiritual approach to acting and what was acting, and that, you know, he was teaching more of a lifestyle for the artist than he was a technique. Because an audition is you need to look at it as an opportunity to practice your craft. That's all it is.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Don't look at it as getting the job, not getting the job. Look at it as a chance to do what it is that you say you love to do. And if you say you love to do it, then why aren't you doing it? You know, and if you have an audition for something, go and audition for it. If you don't get it, at least you had a chance to practice your craft. Because not often, he said, there's a psychosis, with actors and artists in general, where, you know, they'll go around telling people, oh yeah, I'm an actor. Oh yeah, I'm a painter. Oh yeah, I'm a poet. I'm this. And he said, you know, it's fundamentally impossible to be something unless you're doing that something.
Absolutely.
So you can't walk around saying, yeah, I'm an actor, unless you're acting.
Yeah.
You can only say you're an actor when you're acting. If you're not acting, then you're eating lunch, or you're doing your side job, or you're whatever. I'm a reader right now. He said you can only be the things that you are in the moment that you're being them. And I was like,
yes,
you know. And so that really, like, it let me just drop that whole egotistical side of this idea that you are something, you know, special to the world because you've been on TV or whatever. And I studied with him for almost 15 years. He ended up passing away from complications of diabetes.
Wow.
Around 2005. And so I studied with him from, you know, late 1994 all the way up until he passed away. And
sounds like an amazing mentor.
He was. Yeah, my son's middle name is Manu.
Wow, now, fantastic. You know,
And I kind of shot myself in the foot, because I also got rid of my PR rep. I stopped doing, you know, the interviews and all of that. I wasn't really going to the red carpets. I wasn't boozing and schmoozing, you know, in the industry. I was just being my artistic self. I was really into the beat poetry scene. I was doing poetry slams and, you know, just like doing all this cool creative stuff. I'm a graffiti artist. I was painting a lot.
Well, it sounds like you were finding yourself. You were finding your path and honing your craft.
Well, yeah, I was actually going back to what it was, because I was a graffiti artist before I became an actor, and I was somewhat known in the graffiti scene even at 11, 12 years old. You know, I was what's called up, meaning, you know, my name was a lot of places, and I kept doing graffiti all the way up into the Parker Lewis days, and again, I kind of like started straying away from a lot of different areas that kept me grounded in a sense, because, you know, in my younger years, in even when I was on Webster, or when I was doing I Know My First Name Is Steven or any other projects at the time, What's Alan Watching or this, I was going back and hanging out with my graffiti buddies and going to graffiti yards on the weekends and all of that. I wasn't like roped up into this, you know, into this Hollywood world, which is a good thing to be a part of if you can do it in a healthy way.
Right.
And then I started getting more roped into that whole Hollywood scene as Parker Lewis became more successful, and all the interviews and the red carpets and this party and that party and this club and that, you know, whatever. And I just, yeah, it was kind of like a getting lost, you know, in that wilderness. And so it was great to rope myself in and get back to a more grounded life experience. And it's been awesome, because, I mean, I still, you know, now, because I kept doing the graffiti art for all those years, you know, when I got into my 30s and 40s, I started actually getting mural jobs. And, you know, no one knows that it's me, that it's, oh yeah, that was painted by Parker Lewis, you know, but I started getting, you know, I started getting actually paid to do like murals on buildings and all because of who I was as a graffiti artist, which anybody who's on Instagram can follow my graffiti page. It's called, it's at the 169, the numbers 169. So the 169, and you can see the, you know, my life experience there as a graffiti writer. But that's something that has also kept me really grounded over the years, is just hanging with dudes who don't have that attitude. But again, like I was saying, as I kind of shot myself in the foot a little bit, because there's a certain amount of trend factor and Hollywood attention and red carpets and picks and pans and interviews and stuff that you want to do as an actor, because that notoriety at least keeps you in the limelight, in the spotlight, you know, and that does help for getting the bigger jobs and the leads on series and all of that, regardless of auditioning, you know. So I needed to, I should have found a balance of both of those worlds, but instead I just cut out all of that altogether. Plus, I didn't like when I'd show up to a photo shoot and they'd be like, yeah, and here's the clothes you're going to wear. And this is how we're going to do your hair. And this is how we want you to pose. And this is, and I was like, I did that at first. And my buddies that I grew up, my homeboys, as it were, you know, my graffiti crew guys and stuff, they'd like grab the teen magazine and like at the graffiti yard, be like, look what I found in my sister's room. And I'd be like in a Superman flying position, right, you know, like on a stool with some ridiculous outfit on. And I'd be like, dude, put that away. Like, what are you doing to me?
It was like alter ego. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like being misrepresented as who I really was. So I was, you know, and now it's just like way too expensive to have a PR agent. Back then it was like $5,000 a month. Now it's like $25,000 a month. You know, I'm like, dude, no, thank you. Wow. I'll just stick to the podcasts.
Yeah, exactly. Now, were you able to like develop a core group of folks? Like you mentioned, Brian Green and Jason Priestley. Did you have like a core group of guys that kind of like resonated with you?
Yeah, and it was really from the graffiti. Like David Arquette was a good, still is a good friend of mine. It was a really good buddy of mine back when we were teenagers. But he was a graffiti artist as well. A lot of people don't know that. Yeah, he was very well known. He tagged the name someone from a crew called KGB, Kids Gone Bad. It was a really notorious crew in Los Angeles at the time. And Balthazar Getty was a very good friend of mine. He was into the hip hop and kind of graffiti scene when I first met him when we were teenagers. And then obviously me and Steven Dorff and Brian Green went to the same school and we all kind of hung out. And then I had my graffiti buddies, you know, outside of that. And some of them went on to, you know, to be successful. Like, unfortunately, Seth Binzer from Crazy Town, even though he passed away recently, he was a really good buddy of mine in the graffiti scene growing up. And Justin Warfield was in a graffiti crew with me, and he's the lead singer from the band She Wants Revenge, which is, you know, a real hip, successful indie rock group. And a bunch of other cats as well, you know. So I'm still friends with, you know, with all these guys. And it's, you know, it's just a cool life experience. I mean, I just went out painting, you know, a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, when did a piece down here locally in St. Petersburg, Florida. And then at the same time did a new mural for a coffee shop that opened up. They opened up a second store up the road, not too far from me, and did a really rad mural there. People can see that on my Instagram pages and stuff. But you know, so I still keep active in that. You know, I've published 3 books of poetry. Those are all on lulu.com as well. I got 3 books of poetry that I've published.
Amazing.
Yeah, because I was during my years in the beat poetry scene and like doing all the poetry jams and at the coffee shops and all that jazz. I mean, I did that for years, like 5-6 years, you know, yeah, on the side. That was like, I was really into that scene. And so I just had tomes of poetry, you know.
Yeah.
I'm like, what am I doing with this? I mean, that's just like, I might as well. I was like, dude, the hustle of trying to, I didn't have a lit agent or anything. and, you know, trying to like get it to Penguin Books or whoever else, or, you know, I'm like, dude, I'll just, I mean, once the age of self-publishing came out, I was like, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. I have a novella that I wrote that's kind of loosely based on my life growing up as a graffiti writer in Hollywood called Venice High that I published. You know, it's a 100 and, you know, maybe 30 page, you know, teen angst kind of drama book that, and then I've published a bunch of screenplays that I've written just for fun.
That is so cool. You're so multi-talented. It sounds like you've done it right. Like I enjoy your career, the unfolding of your career, and you could have went down so many dark roads. You know, it sounds like you've been pretty blessed to be able to tap into all your gifts and talents. That is so cool. And getting back to your mentor that you mentioned, like, have you been able to become a mentor to someone else and pay it forward? It sounds like you have a lot to offer.
Not really. I mean, I would really love to do acting workshops, you know, character study workshops, something that it doesn't necessarily, you know, take me completely out of the loop. Although if I had, you know, I would like to have an acting class myself and teach regularly. But again, I don't want to end up in a situation because I am, you know, still consistently working actor. I got a movie that just came out called Joe Baby with Deacon Lachman and Harvey Keitel and Ron Perlman. You know, great cast in that. I got a nice little role in that, and got another film coming out later this year called Kill Trip, which is a rad thriller. Just had another movie that'll be coming out later this year called Myra, which is like an action thriller. One called Buster Brooks, which is a wonderful kind of touching. I wouldn't call it a kids movie, but a family kind of film that'll be out later. It's hopefully later this year or next year. I just had a movie come out recently within the last couple of weeks as well called Kid Detectives, where me and my good buddy David Faustino have teamed up again as a comedy duo. But it's a kids movie. The kids are the stars of it, but we're the bad guys.
Yeah.
And it's very funny stuff. And then in more recent times, in the last year, I've had a movie called Place of Bones that came out, where I'm starring opposite Heather Graham and Tom Hopper. It's an incredible a thriller set in the Wild West that is such a great movie. Audrey Cummings did an incredible job directing it. I highly recommend anybody seeing Place of Bones. And one called I Feel Fine that also came out in a really lovely indie film, a heart-wrenching story about teen suicide. That was very well done, and I played the lead in that. And I wrote a script that came out in the last couple of years called Dead Man's Hand, which was a Western. I was the writer of that screenplay as well, and that starred Stephen Dorff and Cole Hauser and Jack Kilmer, Val Kilmer's son.
Wow.
And I have another film that I wrote that came out in the last year and a half that I wrote, produced, and acted in, called Deadly Justice, with a great group of actors, friends of mine that I brought on board for that. And we shot that in Mississippi, the same place where you saw the banner on Corandemic TV on YouTube for Blackwater Blues. We shot the pilot episode for that series that is not picked up yet, but we shot that in South Mississippi too, which was created by Jason London and I wrote the script and all of the future episodes of that. But our pilot episode turned out cool. Anybody who wants to watch Blackwater Blues can go to Corandemic TV and watch the pilot episode on there. It turned out really good, and I'm very proud of it, and shocked that we hadn't been able to sell it, because we submitted it to a ton of short film and TV, independent TV festivals.
Yeah.
And we have like a list of laurels that we've won that's like a mile long. We've won, I mean, we've won like, I got maybe 20, you know, 20 wow, different
congratulations.
Awards. And yeah, and like, Ian, that still didn't help. I'm like, what the hell is this? But again, I don't have lit representation in Hollywood, and without strong lit representation, it's an uphill battle.
Yeah. You know, I dig your YouTube channel. I like watching the content on there. And you had, there was a clip I was watching of the tree planting ceremony in Jerusalem. And you were over by the tree that Sharon Stone had planted. And I was wondering if you'd talk about that experience up there with the tree planting ceremony.
Yeah, that was my second time doing that. I have two olive trees on the Mount of Olives. One that I planted back during the Parker Lewis days, and that was near the tail end of Gulf War I. That was my first experience being at a hotel when sirens go off, warning of an impending Scud missile attack. Wow. You know, I was like, dude, maybe I picked the wrong time to be in Israel. but yeah, man, you know, that's a magical experience for me. I think that you know, going up on Masada as well, the Jewish stronghold that held out against the Romans for so long, and when the Romans finally got to the top of Masada, and actually Masada used to be where the castle of King Herod was, which he was a diabolical individual in history, but it's as far as archaeological sites and mystical spiritual locations in the Middle East, it's certainly up there on the list. And my first time being there when I was a teenager, I had a pretty magical experience as well. I'll just be perfectly honest. I had gotten a little hash while I was over there in Israel, and got to sneak off into a different part of the Masada when nobody else was around, and burned a little, and sort of like felt like I had been there before, you know. Yeah. Sort of had this magical moment of like, wow, man, I feel like, you know, like sort of if anybody's into the belief in reincarnation, which I won't say yes or no to, but to me, I felt like there was something about that world, that place, that land that I was like, dude, I feel like I've been here. Like, this is symbolic. Something's happening. Or it was the hash. One of the two.
Hey, I get this.
but then when the second time that we were there at Masada, I was there with my sister, and we were up there, and we were with the I forget the gentleman's name, but they call him the Indiana Jones of Israel. He's like the big archaeologist guy there, and he was showing us around, telling us some stuff about it. And while we were up there, one of these static electric events took place.
Wow.
Where we're there, and suddenly everything became electrified. All the metal railings, you get zapped by them, like when you rub some warm sheets together, you know, you get that crink. And then everybody's hair rose up off their heads, I swear to God, and were just up in there, and cell phones stopped working. And it was this crazy, and the dude who's been there, he's been the archaeologist there since like 1974 or whatever. And he was like, dude, he's never experienced it in his life the whole time he's been there.
Wow.
And he's heard about that phenomenon happening in different places, but he had never experienced it there on Masada or ever experienced it himself ever in general. But so, you know, that was another moment where I was like, dude, it feels like, you know, this was supposed to be like, I'm once again back in a place that like resonates something, some deeper meaning for me. And that was really cool. And while I was there, we got to go into some underground tunnels below the Temple Mount and places that they don't allow the public access to, and see some digs that they had done down underneath there. And you can't believe how deep that the wall goes that surrounds the Temple Mount. It goes so far underground, you know. It's pretty amazing. And just, you know, there's a love I have for that region of the world, you know. On my father's side, you know, we have Romani Jews going back into Eastern Europe on my father's side, although they converted to Catholicism when they came to the U.S. in the 1920s to avoid the anti-Jewry,
right?
You
know, course.
So,
yeah.
So, but there's just something about that area that I had some similar experiences when I was in Thailand, not quite as spiritual as that, but there's something about Thailand with the Buddhism there and the spirituality that's there that's just ingrained in that society and that culture. And some of the areas we filmed with the incredible Buddhist monasteries and temples up in the mountains that I got to visit. And the temperament, you know, it's 80% plus Buddhist in Thailand.
Wow.
And, there's a certain kind of temperament and soulfulness that they exude, that's very unexpected, especially when you see some of the abject poverty that many of them endure and the conditions that they live in over there that here in the West, we would just find absolutely unacceptable. And over there, they're so happy. They're like, yeah, I got a dirt floor. So what, yeah, man?
They're grateful.
You know, there's something about, Buddhism that can put the soul at ease within, you know, difficult and hard circumstances, But the Israeli trip, that was cool. I mean, having two trees on the Mount of Olives to me is one of the coolest things that I have in my repertoire.
Yeah,
you know, I haven't planted just one. I've planted two olive trees.
What's better than one? Two.
Two, yes. Exactly. And I'm going to go back and I'm going to plant a third one at some point.
Yes, three's my lucky number. I love that. You sound very in touch with your soul. Those are such blessed experiences to get to be a part of. Wow. What does family life look for you right now? What does that look like for you?
Yeah, man. I'm married down here in Florida. I've been married going on two years now, and been with my wife for 3 years. We have a lovely home, happy family, and an incredible corgi. Come here, Theodore. Come here, buddy. Come here. Let me introduce you. Come on, get this stretchy. Come here, sir. Come here. Yes, there he is.
Beautiful.
Theodore Corgivelt.
Beautiful.
Yes, Theodore Corgivelt, the rough rider.
Yes.
He's a very presidential dog. Look at that guy. Look at that guy. Wonderful.
Amazing. Fella. Now you guys, and you have one son?
And I have two kids with my previous, my ex-wife. I have a daughter who's married now to a wonderful guy, a military fellow. They have they have their first kid. So I'm officially a grandpa, yes, which is bizarre. And my son's 20 and he is, he's doing great. He still lives in Texas, currently. And, you know, I'm just blessed. My daughter was born when I was, only 21. And, that was also a major life changer for me that really also grounded me in many ways, that was very welcome, you know, that because a lot of my buddies at that time and in the early, you know, in 93 and the mid 90s, the partying scene, the going out scene, that was like really, really taking over people's lives and including mine to a certain degree up to that point. Although I was so busy working, I didn't have as much time as some of my friends, but once she came into the world, it was like, yo, it was a game changer. It just changed the whole dynamics of what's important. And, I welcomed it. It wasn't like, oh my God, this is the end of the world for me. It was like, wow, this is rad. Yeah. You know, I mean, I get to also be a young dad and, she turned out just, both my kids have just turned out so, so wonderful. And I got a stepson who's 15 going on 16 and he's just he's a really, really lovely young man, very kind, caring. My wife has done a great job with him and that's, you know, that it's just great to see my kids, both of them, and my stepson as well. It's just great to see them not caught up in the BS that some of these young kids are caught up in, the TikToking, the online yada yada. My son's like he's studying with a speaking of Buddhism, he's studying with a Vietnamese Buddhist nun, because he wants to become like, he's a practicing Buddhist, but he's like, Dad, I want to become, like a Buddhist monk. And I'm like, oh, that's a great idea. I'm totally for it, but you also got to pay bills.
Right.
he's desperately wants to go over to India and also live at an ashram and do that whole thing. And I'm for that. I'm like, you got to save up for it. I'll obviously help you all, financially. I'll do what I can to help you to accomplish that, even go with you. Cause I was like, at one point he was like, I was like, so what's your plan? He's like, well, I'm going to, just buy a ticket and just show up there. And I'm like, son, I did a movie in India. Right. I was there for 5 weeks, 6 weeks or so. And let me tell you something, it is not the place you just get off an airplane at without a plan.
Right.
It's crazy. It's a shit show over there. And there's some cool stuff going on, but in between the cool stuff is total complete pandemonium and chaos.
Right.
and I was so shocked because I'd been in, obviously I'd worked in Thailand, on Operation Dumbo Drop. And then I'd also done some work over in the Philippines too. And I was, kind of familiar with the vibes in those those kind of countries where there's an element of deregulation that's gone off the rails. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But nothing like the experience I had in Mumbai in India, like Manila, Bangkok, they did not hold a candle to the chaos of Mumbai. And, I was like, wow, man, this is, you gotta have a thick skin to really be able to confront the level of poverty and chaos that's experienced there. So anyway, I was like, you got to have a plan. You can't just do it willy nilly.
Well, you know what? It sounds like you do get to pay it forward with the mentorship that you received, because now you get to be, you get to have a son, a daughter, and a bonus. So
That's true. I certainly, me and my son definitely on, as far as like, he's really into reading, which is unusual for his generation. I still have a really, really, a bold and interesting library. He grew up around that, and he, grew up with us having a little bit deeper conversations or maybe hearing me talking to one of my buddies about, kind of the more deeper esoteric side of the nature and life and spirituality, that kind of like not by the book mentality. That sort of like rebel, metaphysical rebel, type of way of thinking and relating to life definitely has become something that he embraces. And we actually had a very heartfelt moment not that long ago, where he thanked me for opening up his eyes, that he's not like a blind sheep,
Beautiful.
Just marching through life, that he sees it, he gets it. He's like, dude, I get it. I see through the veil. And I was like, yeah, man.
Well, there can't be a bigger compliment than that. I mean, wow. As a father, as a mentor, wow. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. You've had such a blessed life. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast.
Now, let me pitch one more thing. Speaking of pitching, I'll be working on a series. I got a reoccurring on a series. It hasn't aired yet. We're already on second season. These are short season series. There's 8 episodes in the first season. I'll be in 4 of the 8 episodes for season 2, and hopefully I'll be in season 3. But it's called Heavy Hitters, and it's about baseball. It is executive produced by Candace Kane, and there is a teaser for it out there. You can Google it and look it up. Heavy Hitters. And that is, it's kind of like that, you know, that show Ballers with the Rock and everything about like the ins and outs of what goes on behind the scenes of Major League Football.
Yeah.
But it's similar, but it's about baseball. And so I start working on that early next month, and very excited about being a part of that as well. So, you know, the work keeps coming. Yeah, there's a lot going on, and we'll definitely set up a time to be in your studio with you, and we can go live, and maybe we'll find some clips of some different things that we can actually play for folks.
I would love it. You're more than welcome. We've got the studio house just 5 minutes from the studio, so you've got a place to stay. Got
fantastic.
All the accommodations for you, and I want to share all your links. Are there any more links you want to share or mention again? We'll put them up in the episode.
I mean, you know, if you go to the letter I and the letter M, I'm Corin Nemec. That's me on Facebook, on Instagram, on X, and then Corin Nemec TV on YouTube. And that's pretty much the main places where I'm available at. YouTube, I haven't really been doing as much as I used to do on YouTube, but there'll be some new stuff. And I have a podcast myself that I do on Sunday nights on KLRN Radio called Corin's Reading Room, where I kind of take books off of my shelf in my library and just go through and go over some of the highlighted areas.
Awesome.
And have like a rad conversation about it. So
perfect. Yeah, that sounds like a great way to pay it forward with the books. I love doing that. Anytime I find a great book, I buy 5 copies and pay it forward to people that I know.
Oh, that's cool. Benefit.
Yeah, I'm gonna pick that book up that you mentioned too from your mentor. That book that you wrote.
Well, no, this is the one I wrote. Yeah. Creating a Character for the Stage or Life. Yeah, I highly recommend it. It's intended to be a fairly short read because, you know, it's short attention span theater out there in the world, but. It's a very much an inspired, free flowing way of writing. But I go through the whole, every aspect of the method that he taught and different techniques and exercises that he had us do and stuff like that. And just, you know, discuss, the idea of creating a character in general, not just for the stage, but our own creating a character for the life that we're living now. So it's a pretty cool book. I recommend it to anybody, not just actors.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to pick it up. I'm not an actor, but I'm definitely going to read that book, and I'm definitely going to get that out. I appreciate you taking the time again to come to the studio, and you are welcome here in person anytime, sir. Thank you so much.
Yeah, man. My pleasure.
All right. All right. Corin Nemec. Follow him on all of his handles. That's a wrap.